Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Good evening and welcome to Allowed at Central Library. Can you all hear me? I think this is on. Oh, great. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which makes all of these Allowed programs, free Allowed programs, possible. So, yes. If you are already supporting Allowed and the other great work of the Library Foundation, from adult literacy to children's reading clubs, I thank you heartily. And if you're not and want to find out more, we have information in the lobby. And you're also, we really appreciate your donations for this evening's program. They really do help us keep this program going. Tonight's program will be a conversation between author Richard Rayner and David Yulin. After their conversation, they will invite you to join in questioning. We will circulate a mic for you, so please wait until it comes to you, as we do record for podcast, and also we have C-SPAN Book TV recording tonight, so you may see yourself on the air in the future. Please turn off your cell phones and pagers before we start, and afterwards, Richard will be signing his book in the lobby, courtesy of our library store, and if you do buy a book here, it does help also support the program and the library. Richard Rayner, a British expat, is the author of 8 books of fiction and nonfiction, as he puts it, about California in general and Los Angeles in particular. He's reported on the Rodney King riots for the literary magazine Granta, on the Northridge earthquake for the UK Guardian, on various movie stars for the New Yorker, and on the LAPD for the New York Times magazine. And his first novel, in a footnote, Los Angeles Without a Map, published back in 1988, was later turned into the least famous film ever to feature Johnny Depp. I like that note. His new book, a wonderful book, A Bright and Guilty Place, Murder, Corruption, and L.A.'s Scandalous Coming of Age, is set in Los Angeles in the Roaring Twenties. And as historian Kevin Starr writes, L.A. the place, L.A. the novel, and L.A. the film are fused into a tour de force of L.A. noir. Here is a panorama of corruption galore, an interwoven narrative of L.A.'s most notorious scandals in a region hollowed out by economic collapse and in the throes of intense religious fervor. In conversation with Richard tonight is David L. Yulin, whom most of you know from many Allowed programs here and as our book editor of the Los Angeles Times. David is the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. And like Richard Rayner, he knows a thing or two about Los Angeles, as he is the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology, which won a California Book Award. He's written for many publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, The New York Times Book Review, and he can be heard on NPR's National Thing, All Things Considered. It's my great pleasure to welcome Richard Rayner and David L. Yulin to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Wow, full house.
Hi. So we're going to talk for a while, and then we're going to turn it over to you guys. This is an interesting for me because Richard and I have been talking about sort of LA and noir and what it means for a long time. So with that in mind, I want to start by asking a question that has absolutely nothing to do with LA or noir. The first time you and I ever spoke a long time ago, you talked about, I think you called it the British model of literary life, the sort of belles-lettrist approach. You know, you write a couple of novels, you write some nonfiction books, you do some journalism, maybe a little film work, and you kind of piece together a career, and I think that your career is kind of an exemplar of that sort of style of approach. So I wanted to ask you about that as a kind of way to conceptualize the writing life.
Yeah, well, it's why it hasn't gone so well. I think that the literary life in London was you go to university, you come out of university with this unfocused ambition to be a writer, you start writing typically for magazines and getting kind of gigs for newspapers and with the hope of writing a book. And my sort of career as a writer really began. I'd been working for kind of rock and roll type magazines and interviewing pop stars and movie stars and stuff like that, all of which was good fun, and writing book reviews. And it came together in a kind of more focused way. And to this man, I kind of owe a lot of both good and bad things when this guy called Bill Buford, who was then editing a literary magazine called Granter out of a hairdresser's salon in Cambridge in England, invited me to go to work for him, and I published a short story about a love affair I'd had, believe it or not, with a Playboy bunny. And it was a long time ago. And Bill encouraged me to, A, get serious about writing and editing, and that story became a book and then kind of launched me on this piecemeal career. And so, yes, it has been that I've patched together something in America that resembled what I had in London, which is to say bits of this, bits of that. Whereas here, I think that, especially in this town, the expectation is that you either write for a newspaper or you write more hopefully for books or TV, or you can be this other kind of, sorry, for TV or film, or you can be this other kind of alien species in LA who is the book writer.
Right.
And you get kind of looked at balefully by these people who are earning, you know, a gazillion times more money than you are. And who sort of say, oh, well, you know, I guess you write too.
Right, right. And then you become the book writer who writes books about Los Angeles, or in some, not exclusively, but a number of your books have been about Los Angeles.
Right.
So what, I guess, I'm interested in sort of you touch on it in the last chapter of this book, which is a personal note where you kind of contextualize what this story means
right.
for you, and talk about your early experiences of LA, some of which I think are come out in LA Without a Map, and then sort of how you kind of got almost seduced against your will by Los Angeles. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the mysterious allure of the city.
Right. I mean, it's you know, my wife and I have lived here now for 18 years, and our kids were born in Santa Monica. So, you know, they are Los Angelinos. And I have never quite been able to explain to myself what the nature of my connection to the place is, which is why I think I've gone on writing and writing about it. But I know that the connection is powerful and is changed. And that, like a lot of people, when I first came here, which was in the early 80s, just before the Olympics, or just around the time of the Olympics, I looked around and thought, oh, God, this place is so great. Everybody's so up for it. It's so not like London. It's so not like Manchester and Bradford. You know, and I'm going to come here and just have a terrific time. And I did. And we came to live here at the beginning of the 90s. And then this was when I'd already had this period of time working for Granter, and the Rodney King riots kicked off. And Bill Buford called me from London and said, get yourself out on the streets. And I said, Bill, you want me to get killed? He said, no, but injured would be good. And so I did, and I wrote a story for Granter about the riots that was published in a lot of places, and indeed, you know, you wonderfully put it in one of your anthologies. And that led to getting a lot of gigs for the New York Times Magazine, and they put it together that because I had this, what Americans erroneously perceive as this charming English persona,
It's the accent. Really.
That I got sent into these kind of situations with institutions, and the first institution was the LAPD, and the New York Times Magazine. In that way, that grand way they do, they said, "Well, Richard, we want you to go and ride around in the back of police cars for 3 months and decide whether what Willie Williams is doing can work." So Joe Rodriguez, the photographer, and I did just that, and we spent a lot of time, unsurprisingly, observing that, you know, that the LAPD wasn't going to change so much after the Rodney King riots, but getting to know a lot of cops, and the photographer was this tough Puerto Rican guy. And one of the cops we got to know was this black homicide detective called Cedric Wilder, who was an ace dude, and he'd been watching us for several days. And Cedric said, "You know, I figured it out what you guys are doing. It's good cop, bad cop." He said, "But there's a twist. People think Richard's the good cop, but really he's the bad cop." But having these experiences of writing about the riots and writing about the LAPD made me feel very differently about the city. I started to see its dysfunctionality, and I really enjoyed the fact that I saw it in a darker way. It began to explain itself better to me. And then over a period of time, and this is really what the source of, you know, this book has narratives that are layered on top of it, and it's very kind of specific about the period of time that it's covering and the stories that it's telling. But one of the things that it's trying to do, or the thing that's most meaningful to me that it's trying to do, is to explain to myself why it is that I feel that this is such a dark place in so many ways, and how that feeling has evolved through history and when it crystallized. And the argument of the book, whether it's right or not, is that feeling that, let's call it for the sake of argument, noir, crystallized in Los Angeles as the boom years of the 20s turned into the early years of the Depression.
Right. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this book, and also about your or about it in line with your other writings about Los Angeles, is that you play on the one hand with the glamour, and then you see the sort of sordidness underneath. And that's one of the things that seems to me to be one of the roots of noir, and it comes out here in terms of, you know, Mulholland and the Dam, in terms of Doheny and the murder of his son, in terms of even the central, I don't know how much we want to actually give away, but the central sort of event at the heart of the book, which right. I'll let you give that away if anyone's going to give it away. Since I think we'll see their pictures up there at a certain point. But it's all about illusion on the one hand, appearance on the one hand, and then this much darker, more complicated thing that's happening underneath, and who has the power and who has the access and how they get it.
Right. I mean, the central story of the book really concerns this, and he's such an Angelino prototype. this very... That's the former chief of the LAPD, J. Edgar Davis. And there's also a wonderful shot that you'll see at some point where he's leading... he was a crack marksman, and the LAPD pistol shooting team was constantly winning world championships, which was one of Davis's big concerns. Anyway, there's a nice shot that will come up at some point of Davis literally organizing a turkey shoot. So you see these LAPD guys blazing away at a couple of hapless turkeys. But the central story of the book is this about this guy called Dave Clark. And as I pieced together the way in which he was connected to many of the other stories that are in the book, I realized that he was kind of in some ways a symbol for me of what LA is. So that he was this guy, very handsome, looked like Clark Gable, tall, slim, tan, had a very pretty wife,
He fought in World War One, was a flyer, came out of World War One. He'd grown up in around downtown, went to USC, didn't actually graduate in law, but took the California bar before doing that, which was kind of more routine then, and went to work for a downtown firm, which primarily represented oil interests, a firm called Wellborn, a splendidly Dickensian name. And Clark got a bit... He wanted the fast track. He married a very glamorous girl who was the daughter of a famous New York judge. He went to work for the DA's office in 1926, soon before Buron Fitts became DA, in an attempt to reform the civic corruption of the city, a process that would really go on throughout the 30s and some would argue way, way beyond that. Clark, as a prosecutor, was involved in these high-profile cases, busting gangsters. He was involved in a big case with the movie star Clara Bow. And then himself, in 1931, was put on trial for double murder, having rubbed out the then head of the LA underworld. And so it's really sort of like a Michael Corleone story of this guy who, for reasons that are still mysterious to me to some extent, just got seduced by the darker side of himself. And also, it was something to do with wanting it all too fast.
And, in the book you talk about this, but this reflects back to what you were saying before. What about this story is so quintessentially Los Angeles? I mean, you say that as you were kind of doing the research and piecing together the information, Clark kept coming up.
Right.
He had these connections everywhere, and you were looking for a way to explore this moment where LA's sort of adult personality, let's say, catalyzed.
Right.
What was it about Clark that made him so representative, and what is it exactly that you think he was representative of?
Well, he was so glamorous. He was very well connected. He was moving between these different worlds, which seemed not to be connected, but in fact are. So the world of LA law, the world of downtown power, the world of Hollywood celebrity, and the world of the LA underworld, which then meant sort of gambling and bootlegging and prostitution and the rackets. And the tightness of the connection between those elements and Clark's particular character, which had a real kind of hard sheen to it. So that he was very brilliant, very suave, very debonair, and really hard to read. And the scariest thing about him is that after he was arrested for the double shooting, that being a lawyer, he had the presence of mind to make no statement to any legal authority for 2 months. And I just thought, well, wow, that someone could actually kind of be able to hold themselves together with that sort of power.
Well, he actually even says to the press at one point, I've been on enough of these cases and seen people
right.
essentially hang themselves by saying
by
too much,
saying,
so I'm not going to say anything.
Right. And I thought he was self-aware and a kind of very modern character in that way. And as I say, that felt to me that was, something typically like L.A.
Now, one of the other things that's very interesting about this case is it is kind of central. It was a huge case. You described it. You described it at one point as the O.J. Simpson trial of its time.
Right.
And yet, it's sort of been lost to history in some sense. I had not known about this case until I read the book. We could poll the room and see who knew about it. How do you think that is? What do you think is the nature of LA and its relationship to its history, that even these sort of big events in a particular moment end up being kind of glossed over or sanded over in some way.
Right. I think they get forgotten because other ones come along. And you know, that if what was fascinating in looking at the Clark murder trials, there were two, because the first one was a hung jury, and which was much more frequent back then, although we've seen with Phil Spector that still happens today too, it was huge. And we're talking about a time when LA had 10 newspapers, and morning editions, evening editions, bulldog editions, extra editions, and this constant procession of print with these wonderful writers cranking out, you know, like you just given me a copy of James Ellroy's new book, but these guys wrote in that way, this really tense, hard-boiled, vivid way. And it was as if the town was demanding it. And in the same way that the town has gone on demanding those huge celebrity trials, these huge celebrity events, where crime and fame and sex and power all mix together. And then once one has happened, it's the nature of this place that it gets forgotten about because there's another one.
Right.
And then there's another one, and then there's another one. And we see the kind of pattern of these kinds of crimes and events just replicate themselves throughout. And there are these, you know, great anthologies of LA true crime. Craig Rice, the mystery writer, did one back in the 40s, and then there's that good anthology, Fallen Angels, which catalogues sort of 20 or 30 of the great LA crimes. And, you know, in the case of Clark, no one had really ever put it together before, which was just amazing. That, you know, why was no one interested in doing this? That 2 months before he shot Charlie Crawford and Herbert Spencer in a room in Hollywood, he'd been up in court with her and defending, or actually prosecuting, Daisy DeVoe, who was Clara's secretary, who was blackmailing Clara Bow for $150,000, and if Clara Bow didn't give Daisy DeVoe the $150,000, Daisy DeVoe was going to go to the press and explain to them how Clara had been banging John Wayne, had been, or Marion
Morrison,
who
at the time was a USC football player. Yeah.
Had some, you know, some say had banged the entire USC football team. And she was a naughty girl, Clara, who liked all sorts of things. And Clara, being spunky, refused to let Daisy DeVoe blackmail her, prosecuted Daisy DeVoe. The prosecution was then carried out by Clark. And it wrecked Clara Bow's career, because indeed all that information did come out. And B.P. Schulberg, the head of Paramount, who'd made his career off the discovery of this Brooklyn girl, dropped her like a stone. And no one had ever really looked into Clark's life enough to notice that 2 months before he shot these two dudes, he'd been involved in this other celebrity trial, but on the other side of the fence. And I thought, well, who is the character? Who was this guy who could, on the one hand, be doing that and pulling that off, i.e. the Clara Bow trial, and then, so soon afterwards, he was up to his neck in some angle of the rackets, which has caused him to be in an argument in a small, heavily defended room in Hollywood and shoot two people.
Now, I wonder how much you think this has to do with, we've also talked about the notion that L.A. as a city is very much like a small town.
Right.
You know, Louis Adamich called it the enormous village.
Right.
Richard Meltzer has called it the biggest hick town in all the hick world. do you subscribe to that view? It does seem to me a city where all of those sort of separate circles of power could come together because there aren't that many people running the show.
Right.
And I'm curious about your take on that and also how much that had to do with the story of a guy like Clark or even the story of L.A. maturing in that period in the late 20s and early 30s.
Well, I think that's certainly true. I mean, if we have to kind of, you know, stop for a moment and think about what Los Angeles actually was in 1920, it was a city with a population of about 500,000. Through the 20s, that population would grow to about 1.2 million. And we're talking about, you know, a boom, the fastest growing city in the world at that point. And a city that was controlled and had indeed been called into being by a very small cadre of powerful men who were concerned to make money by making the city grow. And
this goes back, I mean, really, to the Owens River Valley.
And so that, you know, we all know the story that Los Angeles doesn't have any water. So Henry Huntington and Harry Chandler and Mulholland and a group of others cook up a plan that we're going to take the water from the Owens River Valley. That is set in motion in about 1907, is brought into completion in 1913 when the water arrives.
Right, but it's preceded. They buy up, the same consortium buys up most of the valley.
San Fernando
which
Valley.
Which is completely worthless
until
they irrigate it with the water they've stolen.
And the water arrives not in Los Angeles, but in the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
And thus making for these people, some say $300 million, something like that. And then L.A. has the ecological ability to grow, and they encourage people to come here to buy the land that they have irrigated that suddenly become much more valuable than it was before. But the hub of the place is still downtown, and downtown is, in 1920, we're still looking at that. So there's not really much between downtown and Santa Monica. Hollywood is starting to grow up. Beverly Hills is starting to grow up. But, you know, you would, if you drove down Wilshire from downtown to the ocean in 1920, you're going to see a lot of orange groves, a lot of bean fields and stuff like that, and not much in between. So we're talking about a place that I know you always cut it out of my copy when I write this, that it seems to me to be like an almost science fictional environment back then. It's so unimaginably different and distant. And the power is in the hands of a small group of people. Mike Davis has that wonderful line, power lines. And that it seems to me that that's still, it was definitely true about LA then, that the power lines were narrow and interconnected, and seems to me to be still true to some extent, that it was a place that, because it had been small, was controlled by a small number of people, and as it became big, which it did very quickly, was still controlled by a lot of the same groups of guys. Although you had the arrival of the movie industry, which then created its own separate power line through the kind of late teens and 20s and into the 30s, and of course, you know, beyond that to now.
Right. And then you also had, I guess, the movie business was sort of West Side Jewish power, and then the oil interests and the money interests were downtown WASP power, so you had some kind of competing power structures there.
Right.
But they all had to play together in a certain sense.
Right. And if we, you know, the major power structure in the 20s was oil.
Right.
And somewhere back there, they'll come up a shot of the Signal Hill oil fields, area down by Long Beach with just a pepper pot of oil rigs. And one of the most extraordinary statistics that I have in the book is that through the 1920s, Los Angeles created, not quite the right word, but brought up 25% of the world's oil. You know, it's amazing. It's one of those really who knew kind of things. And Doheny, who had first found oil in the late 1880s in the La Brea tar pits, was at the time the richest man in America, briefly in the early 1920s, although Doheny actually made the first kind of nugget of his fortune through the discovery of oil in LA, but then realized that actually the way to get really, really rich was to control the entire oil production of Mexico, which is basically what Doheny did from about 1905 until the time of the Mexican Revolution. Yes, the power lines were centered around the boosters, the landowners, the LA Times, enormously powerful, and then oil, which at that time, you know, Doheny money was sort of establishment LA money. In other words, it was sort of 10, 15 years old, which back then seemed like, or indeed was, a very long period of time in the city's history. And then we have, I was talking to Don Waldie, the wonderful writer DJ Waldie, about the arrival of Hollywood and the immigrant, the different sort of immigrant influx. So you mentioned Adamek earlier. Adamek was this Slovenian guy who came to Los Angeles in the late teens and was sort of the city's first Boswell. And he wrote a wonderful book, which is almost impossible to find and long out of print, called Laughing in the Jungle.
Laughing in the Jungle, yeah.
And which is a series of essays and collects kind of diaries that he'd written of his early experiences in Los Angeles. And he says it's a city full of old people. And in the early 1920s, that was true.
Right.
It was the people who'd come from the Midwest and been encouraged to come here with their retirement money because it was warm and you could kind of die in comfort and warmth listening to Amy Semple McPherson on the radio. And Don Waldie's point is that in some way, Los Angeles called Hollywood into being because it needed young people to come here. So he has this kind of flip idea of the usual explanation, which is that the filmmakers came here because, as Lawrence Wexler says, there's 18 times more light, or
right,
whatever it is. But so this lovely idea that Waldie has that, you know, we actually, in order to, again, for the city to continue to grow, it needed younger people.
So that's a kind of vampiric vision.
Right.
But it's interesting because I think, you know, the other thing that you get at in the book, and that, I mean, you know, Adamich got at this, and Carrie McWilliams certainly, and Fonte and Nathaniel West wrote about it in Ask the Dust and in Day of the Locust, is the emptiness of that, that Midwestern retiree life, that there was no spiritual or civic core,
right?
You know, no sense of connection. So that there was this enormous amount of kind of boredom and unfocusedness to it. And I wonder, and you sort of talk about that, the roots of, or the role of that in the roots of noir and in the roots of some of the kinds of, you know, horrific and unimaginable crimes. You talk about the woman who had her lover in the cage for 15 right. years and in the attic and finally let him out so he could kill her husband.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's an only in L.A. kind of
right.
kind of event, you know.
Well, you know, Walpurga Oesterich is the name of the wonderful lady. And,
she was the that, she wasn't the tiger.
No, that's a different one. Clara Tiger Woman Phillips is the the woman who beat to death the rival for her lover with a claw hammer. But Kerry McWilliams, who wrote the great book about the early history of Los Angeles, Island on the Land, said proudly, or wrote proudly, Los Angeles has the best murders ever. And I think we still do. And in the 20s, there was this parade of them. So there was Walpurga Oesterrich, who, as you say, the lover locked away upstairs until he's allowed to kind of come down and kill the husband. clearly, all this is kind of feeding into, you know, it's a very James N. Cain scenario. Tiger Woman Phillips, who is kills the other woman with a claw hammer, escapes from jail, goes down to Honduras, is tracked down by this wonderful figure who reports for the Examiner called Maurice Levine, who gets to her hotel in Honduras and says, you know, his rationale for making her come back here so he can get his story is, you know, who are you really? Are you going to hide away here, or are you really Clara Tiger Woman Phillips, in which case you will come back with me to Los Angeles and greet the popping flashbulbs and enjoy the fame that you will undoubtedly have? She came back.
I'm ready for my close-up.
Right, exactly. And there was, you know, the Hickman murder, the guy who kidnapped the little girl. He thought that this was the time when people were pre-Lindbergh, but when kidnapping seemed as though something that people could actually get away with, so he kidnapped this girl and then was holding the family for ransom and showed up at a meeting with the girl's father. This is an awful story. And by this time, he'd killed the girl, but he'd sewed her eyelids up to her skull so it looked as though she was in the car with her eyes open alive. And when he was finally caught, said, "Am I as famous as Leopold and Loeb?" And there was really just a kind of procession of these tales through the 20s. And I think that what I believe is that sort of the ethos of Los Angeles somehow needs them. And that you still see it now, like that things, the stories are so outlandish, like the Robert Blake murder case. That so there's the shooting, and Blake's story is that when the shooting took place, I was on my way back into the restaurant to collect a gun that I left on the table, and that's his alibi. And it's the town needs these events, and I, you know, what I did in the book, I think, was to kind of get at why it is that generation of writers who started to write in the Depression. We're talking about Cain, we're talking about Horace McCoy, we're talking obviously about Raymond Chandler. They were all here, and they were fueled to create this type of writing, not just by the development of a kind of a style, but that there was a lot more reportage in what they were doing than we now assume. So I wanted to kind of step back from that into some of the real events that may have actually caused them to write what they did. And I almost fell off my chair when I realized, you know, at some point I had to go back and read a lot of Chandler, which was, you know, no great burden to have to do that, because he remains, you know, in many ways, the greatest kind of poet of what I'm talking about, and, you know, found that he had indeed, in a kind of throwaway scene in one of the early short stories, actually described what was clearly the Dave Clark case.
Yeah, that was fascinating. And I also think what's interesting, because as a reader, reading, say, Chandler or Cain or any of those writers of the 30s, and not even the hard-boiled writers, but again, to bring it back to Fonte and West, right, because... Because Day of the Locust and Ask the Dust and The Big Sleep all came out in the same year.
Right.
1939, and all share a kind of hard-boiled, noirish point of view. You know, there's the great riff at the beginning of Ask the Dust where Fonte talks about, you know, he had the letter from the landlady paying the rent. It was a letter requiring serious attention, so he went to sleep, right, which could have come right out of Chandler. And I always wondered, you know, it wasn't that, so there had to be something in the air. That it wasn't that Chandler was creating L.A. noir any more than, say, Hammett was creating noir. They weren't creating, it wasn't a style. It had to be a response to something that they were, that these writers were experiencing on the ground.
Yeah, I think that's very true and very, very well put, that there was, and when you talk about those three writers, you're talking about writers who feel, you know, at this distance to be really different kinds of writers.
And, I don't think, at least in 1939, could have known each other or would have known each other. I've never been able to see a point of intersection.
No, I don't think so.
Together.
I think that kind of Fante moved in, it's hard to imagine that West and Chandler would have known each other, and I don't think that they did. And Chandler, as Judith Freeman, you know, writes so well about the weirdness of his life in Los Angeles in her book, The Long Embrace. And he was kind of older than them and already sort of a kind of more disappointed figure in 1939, even though that was the moment when he was just starting to achieve his fame, which is one of the kind of really fascinating things about Chandler. And West was really a much more sort of glamorous figure who was connected with Perelman through marriage and was more of a sort of New York literary figure and had probably published Miss Lonely Hearts back in New York, I would have thought.
Before he came out. Before he came out, yeah. And was chided by Edmund Wilson, who was friendly with Edmund Wilson, and Wilson used to write him letters telling him he was burning out his talent by hacking it out for the studios.
Right. You know. And yet that book does have that sort of distilled, nightmarish, that book being Day of the Locust, that distilled nightmarish, noirish quality, which is just what we're talking about, this thing that where you stand on the street in blazing sunlight. And I don't know if you've seen this shot back here yet, but there's a picture of Dave Clark. There's a sunlit street scene, which says to me everything that the book's about, which is the brilliant hard light of Los Angeles and the shadow. And when you just feel at sort of 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that awful emptiness that, oh, what the heck am I going to do? Which is a feeling that I've never quite had in any other city in the world in the way that I've experienced it here, which is that sort of scary, you know, almost a sort of despairing feeling that I just never had in London, certainly never had in New York or Helsinki or other places I know, where you just sort of, there seems to be nothing to do here and no reason to be here. And Los Angeles seems so oppressive and so awful. And I think that this is an experience, these kind of moments of shattering sunlit horror that writers, you know, throughout the history of literary LA have had.
And yet the other side of it, which I'd be remiss, I wanted to talk about Leslie White a little bit, because he represents the other side of it. He's sort of the opposing pole,
right,
of the story to Dave Clark. And he's a guy who, you know, it really was a land of opportunity in a lot of ways, financially certainly, but also in terms of possibilities, life choices, opportunities of things to do. This is a guy who started out as a photographer. I mean, you can tell his story a little bit, but kind of ended up being everywhere,
right,
of importance, you know, during this 5 or 6 year period in all sorts of different roles.
Yeah, this really, and the book kind of pairs these two guys, White and Clark, as the kind of the light and dark. And White was this guy who had come out of Canada originally, and his family had moved to Ventura County. And he had a succession of, worked in a gas station, had a succession of kind of low-level law enforcement jobs, and by 1928 was a photographer in Ventura. And Mulholland, having realized that the water that had been taken from the Owens River Valley actually wasn't going to be enough, and there was a drought in the 20s, so Mulholland built two dams. One, the Hollywood Reservoir Dam, which is still there, and another one up in the San, I always have trouble stammering on this, the San Francisco Canyon, got it approximately right, just northeast of Ventura. And one night in 1928, this dam gave out. So wall of water, 200 feet high. It's a story that's really like the Titanic. So this wall of water, 200 feet high, is released and spends 3 hours beating its way down to the ocean. And as it does that, and you imagine when a dam bursts, okay, it must be happening fast. And this wall of water, in fact, at the moments of original release, is moving 18 miles an hour. So it's fast, but it's not that fast. So people on motorbikes are out racing it, trying to warn people down the valley of the disaster that's about to hit them. So this wall of water sweeps down to the ocean. Many people are killed. Nobody really knows how many, because a lot of the people were immigrant farmers who were then as now needed, then as now here illegally. So no one was really too interested in their fate, but the death figure is somewhere between 400 and 700, depending on which book you read and who you talk to. But White, who's a photographer, gets a call in the middle of the night saying, you know, there's an airplane waiting, the St. Francis Dam just gave out. And White said, well, what's the St. Francis Dam? He'd never even heard of it vaguely. It was sort of 30-40 miles away. So he flies up in the airplane, and in his book, Me Detective, writes about seeing these, as dawn breaks, seeing these specks down in the foaming waters below and realizing that they're human figures, either dead or human figures still struggling to survive. And this is kind of still a hot topic in Ventura County today, because LA County water killed Ventura County people. And the first thought in the minds of the powers that be in Ventura County was lawsuit. And so they started assembling evidence, and White was recruited to help compile a citizen's report. So he had to take morgue pictures of bodies as they were found, as an evidentiary component of the report that was being put together. And eventually I tracked down these pictures proudly. None of them have ever been published, and I was one of the very first people, I think, ever to kind of bother to try and find them. And, you know, some of the bodies he'd found were found the next day. So White's pictures are as if someone's just gone to sleep. Some of the bodies were found 3 months later, and then you're talking about real kind of waxworks horror stuff. And I probably got all these public pictures, never been seen by anybody, sent them to Doubleday. We can't publish those! They were just actually just too harrowing. But as a result of this work, White's lung hemorrhaged. And he came to Los Angeles, as a lot of people did at that time, believe it or not, for his health, and landed a job because he had this forensic experience with the DA's office, which had then, you know, we mentioned Buron's Fitz before, had just been taken over by Fitz. And Fitz was in the process of reshaping it and was recreating the district attorney's investigative unit. And White got a job as a forensics guy. And this is when his life starts to intersect a bit with Clark's. And they're working in the same building down there in the Hall of Justice. And White works the Doheny murder-suicide case. He had known in Ventura a well-known Ventura County lawyer who he met again in Los Angeles, who said, you know, you should turn your, you've got this great material. Magazines are all over.
Well, he had a crisis. I mean, it was a classic LA moment. He had this crisis where he didn't want to do it anymore. And then this guy said, it's great material.
Right. And this guy who said that was Earl Stanley Gardner, and who White had known in Ventura. So White, while he's still working for the DA's office, starts to turn himself into a pulp fiction writer, and is publishing, you know, in Black Mask and many of the other pulps while he's still working at the DA's office. And indeed, in one of the cases in which he's... this is a great LA moment that I didn't really give too much of in the book, but in one of the cases that he was giving evidence for, the attorney smartly said, well, Your Honor, this guy publishes fiction. He's just making all his evidence up. He's just concocting a plot and a story in the way that he does, in the way when he submits something to one of these tawdry pulps. And White, disillusioned by what he sees in the DA's office, eventually packs it in and becomes a full-time writer, which actually through the early part of the 30s, he's doing much, much more successfully than Raymond Chandler was at that time. So he's publishing books with Harcourt Brace.
His mentor is Lincoln Steffens.
Lincoln Steffens. Yeah. He's encouraged to write his memoir, which I would love to try and get someone to reprint. He wrote this excellent memoir, which actually Kerry McWilliams references in his book, which I think is how I first heard about it. Me, Detective, is White's memoir, and a couple of novels, which are really like sort of early police procedurals. And he was a kind of gung-ho, very excitable kind of writer, but he had a real knack for storytelling. And he's one of these guys who just kind of went on reinventing himself. So he'd been a photographer, he became an investigator, he became a writer, and at first he was a crime writer because that was what he knew. Then he became a kind of a gossip-mongering magazine editor. Then he became a historical romance writer. And finally, having kind of gone to live in Connecticut, this is my favorite detail about this guy, and having raised a family on a farm, and or the second family that he had by his second wife, he becomes the editor of the National Model Railway Association magazine.
It's a classic LA story. So this raises one last question, or it's a two related last questions, I guess, and then we'll turn it over to questions from the audience. But this, in the first place, this is really, in some ways, what you're uncovering here is the shadow history of Los Angeles, both in terms of, say, of White and Clark, but also when you, in terms of the literature of LA, you know, there are all of these books. You talk about a lot of them here. Whether it's White stuff, which is long out of print and no one has seen in a long time, or Myron Brinig's The Flutter of an Eyelid, which is one of my favorite books that nobody's ever read, which are great books and really fascinating and illuminating windows on the culture of the city, both in their moment and now, but basically, for all intents and purposes, don't exist. But at the same time, it's very much like the culture we're living in now. I mean, you know, it's even the description of LA at that time, it's a time of economic disaster,
right.
Massive unemployment, ethnic tensions, immigration issues, corruption, or at least government that isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing. And in some ways, I think even when you describe the newspapers, the way the newspapers worked with all their with the extras, that was the emerging technology. Those newspapers function. I mean, you could follow the Michael Jackson funeral motorcade yesterday on the internet on various websites, point by point, right. Because they were updating constantly. So it feels like there are all these echoes back and forth. So on the one hand, it is this shadow history, but on the other hand, it's really profoundly relevant. And I just wondered, I just wanted to get your sense of that, your thoughts on that, on how that works, and whether that's really a quintessentially Los Angeles thing, this loss of history or this history of forgetting. notion more so than in other cities, or do you think that we now have entered into a culture where that's much more broadly, where LA's culture of forgetting has taken over the world?
Well, I think the latter point may be true, that the Norman Klein, Norman Klein's beautiful book, the history of forgetting is the history of Los Angeles, it being his kind of thesis, and this part of the city's DNA about how we seize on these moments and transform them into needed public spectacle, and then instantly dispose of them. That seems to me to be something that's still true, and that it may be that what's happened actually is that the rest of the world has just started behaving like that also, as, you know, it's been one of Los Angeles' great gifts to civilization, maybe. But I don't know. That seems like that, you know, that could be the case.
Well, let's turn it over to you guys for a little bit. We have microphones. Raise your hand, and someone with a microphone will come. We have one in the front row. Oh, there's your picture.
Yeah, there's the sun. That's Clark. It's the tall guy, three from the left. This is Albert Marco, who was a gangster, and you see him there shortly after being involved in a fight at the Ship Cafe, that was a cafe on Venice Pier.
Covered in blood.
Well, Marco kind of, you know, trying to disguise the extent of his wrongdoing, had removed his shirt, because his shirt had too much blood on it. But he still got quite a bit anyway. And Marco was this plug-ugly gangster who was a henchman of Charlie Crawford, who is the man who Clark eventually rubs out.
There's that hand up over there.
Thank you. Richard, I'd like to hear about your research process. I mean, where are the real archival sources for the 20s and the 30s?
Well, that's sort of... they're all over. I mean, it depends on what you're... I've done things that have been archived in different ways, so that the previous nonfiction narrative history to this was a book I read about a Depression-era con man, where there were a lot of prison records, and I got those through a friend or a guy who became a friend of mine in the National Archives. You just realize these people are sort of invaluable resources when you find them. A lot for this was, you know, obviously there were trial transcripts, and then just a lot of going through, and it seems to me what this book was an attempt to connect certain dots that no one had really ever bothered to try to connect before. So I did a lot of constructing very detailed timelines of by looking at newspaper stories of just when sort of, you know, even with the Clark murder day, but not at that moment in the timeline for the book, it was hour by hour. Well, where was he at that moment? According to, you know, what did the Illustrated Daily News say about it? What did the Examiner say about it? What did the LA Times say about it? What did the Express say about it? What did the Herald say about it? So I was going and then comparing that with his own testimony to sort of weave together a narrative. So, you know, I try and read as much, look at as much. I love having old photos in my hand and old documents. There's something kind of very exciting about that process. So, and really, you can just go on and on and on. There's never any end to research, and you realize that my God, I should have actually done that extra trip somewhere else. But you know, eventually the moment comes when you just sort of you've got the narrative and the writing takes over and the research stops. So, but it's a very involved but fun. I love doing research.
Mr. Rayner, you mentioned a lot of really great books that were published in the 1930s that are out of print, and I'm curious if you're familiar with one called Los Angeles by Mauro Mayo, and if that had any effect with what you're writing about, because it has to do with a lot of that period and the sure. scandalous beginnings of Los Angeles.
Right, I think that's a wonderful book, and especially in its telling of the Owens River Valley story. He gets that... I know, it's not a favorite of yours, that book, is it?
It's okay. It's I like Cedric Belfrage's telling of that story better because it's very red.
Right. Well, Mayo was I think a New York journalist who came out here and then pulled together that book kind of quite. It has the energy of being written kind of quickly, and it is a bit clunky. But nonetheless, he realized that he'd seized on this amazing stuff that had never really been written about before. But I guess that book got superseded quite quickly. And as I say, I like that book, but it got superseded quickly by the Cary McWilliams book.
Within about 10 or 12 years.
Within about 10 years, which is, you know, there's no question that the McWilliams book is a lot more thoughtful and better done.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about the McWilliams book is even 60-some years later, right, because it came out in 46, yeah. It's still completely right on.
It's a genius book.
Yeah, that's brilliant. We recommend it highly to everyone who hasn't read it. There's a hand up in the back.
Can you confirm or deny a story about the food emporium next door to Central Market? About 15 years ago, the lady manager and her boyfriend disappeared and were found a few months later in the meat locker. And there had been a city meat inspection in the process, in the period of time between the disappearance and the discovery. It's worthy of a movie, I think.
I think that might be my next book. I don't know. Yeah. I'm sorry, I don't know anything about that, so it's great, though.
You want to get the guy in the aisle there?
Since this was about, or it seems to be in the 20s, the roaring 20s, and you know, I don't know much about that time, but we seem to perceive it as decadent and free-flowing and everything going. Was it tempered by this kind of behavior? Was it tempered in L.A. during the Depression? Or have we just been crazy for the last 80 years?
I think that it's interesting. Throughout the 20s and the 30s, that sort of decadence is answered always, as it is in L.A., by a form of Puritanism, and which is also, which came from the ethic that the Midwesterners brought here with them. And in the period that's in terms of the book, that was, we're talking about the early days of radio, and the most powerful influences in radio at that time were the evangelists. So you have Amy Semple McPherson, who was, essentially selling her kind of bizarre version of love through God. And then the other great 20s evangelist was the Reverend Fighting Bob Schuller, who used radio as a political tool. He was one of the first people to do that. And what he seized upon was the fact that, what his flock wanted to hear about was how awful and decadent the movie folk were. And, how we must hold up the flag for the values that we represent, and that there are the true American values. And I see, that tension has always been, and especially then, was a part of what the city was and still is to some extent. And I'm not sure whether that pattern of behavior changes through economic changes. I don't think it really does. I think that tension sort of runs beneath whether we're in a prosperous moment or an impoverished one.
Gentleman in the front.
I don't really know anything about L.A. history, and I find it interesting that a DA would end up killing a couple gangsters.
An assistant DA.
All right. Whatever happened to him? Did he get away with it since they were gangsters?
Well, it's a good question. He did get away with it. He got away with it on self-defense. And this is Dave Clark, the main character in the book. So he held his nerve, never told his tale. Legal procedure was different then. He could arrive in court on the day when everybody knew he was going to tell the story, having never uttered a breath of it. People don't really believe him. He's this handsome dude. He's managed to get lots of women on the jury. He wanted women on the jury. So he gets acquitted, finally, after the first trial. It's a hung jury, and then the second trial, he's acquitted. And he becomes a mouthpiece. You know, he becomes, in effect, a kind of a gangster's lawyer. He works for this guy called Guy McAfee. And Clark's career prospers through the 40s with McAfee, who I'm sure was the model for Eddie Mars in Chandler's The Big Sleep. But the sad tale about Clark is that his glamorous life kind of spirals down into the 50s, and he's still a lawyer, but he's not doing well, and he's staying with a friend, and it's Veterans Weekend. They've both got blasted. This is a guy who he was at USC with back in the 20s. We're now in the 1950s. And Clark wakes up his friend and says, I think I just killed your wife. And the wife had got involved in a, while her husband had passed out, she'd been accusing Clark of mooching off them. Clark had reached for a shotgun in a rage and blown her away. And at that moment, 20 years on, everybody realizes Clark murdered Crawford and Spencer. And the tragic thing about the story is that his own wife, who by then had divorced him, Nancy, the pretty lady who's standing by him in the jail cell, always held a candle for Clark. This I got from Nancy's granddaughter, even when they were separated. And when Nancy hears the story of the second murder, she herself soon has a heart attack and dies. It's very, very sad. But as to kind of what happened to him, you know, how does someone get eaten away like that? I don't really know, but he did.
If you look at all the images on the screen, they're fascinating images, but they're all images of white people. Right. And I only bring that up, not for political correctness, but to ask you if you think that something fundamental has happened to change L.A. With the immigrations, particularly of the 70s and 80s, and the fact that the city is now a plurality Latino city, whether we're looking at a world that's gone with the wind, or whether you still think all of the factors that created your work are still operative?
Well, that's a very, very excellent question. I think there are, and Mike Davis, you know, maybe one of those people who would say that the kind of the idea of LA as a noir place is a specifically white concern. And that may be so. And, you know, there was, of course, the Latino immigration was, I don't know what the percentages were, but we're talking, you know, that still would have been very, very substantial back then. But really, you're talking about, when Adamick writes about it, he describes a very white place. I think it was a very white city. And I guess the African-American influx really starts in the the 30s and 40s, isn't it, with them?
The war, pre-war, late right. 30s. I mean, you have, what's his name, Lummis, Charles Fletcher Lummis, who was the city editor of the L.A. Times, but also the head of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, who wrote ad copy describing Southern California as a paradise for the Saxon homemaker.
Well, yeah, it's called, you know...
to draw white people from Midwestern cities.
And indeed called, that's triggered my something with me. It was called the white spot of America. That indeed that was a selling point.
Okay, we have time for one more.
You guys have referenced an amazing number of obscure, forgotten books and have made this really good point about how the history of Los Angeles kind of exists in these books that don't exist anymore. I just have to ask you if either of you know a 1932 novel called Praise the Lord by Dilwyn Parrish. This is getting very obscure, but it's about an Iowa family that comes to Los Angeles and essentially goes insane one person at a time. Seriously, the mother is a disciple of Amy Semple McPherson, who has a different name in the book, and she takes the abuse from her husband for only so long, and then she kills him and goes to prison and dies in prison. Their daughter gets knocked up by a soda jerk. The son becomes a kind of drifter around town and ends up owning a gas station in Santa Monica Canyon. A great book. I recommend it.
It sounds like... I don't know it. It's interesting how many of these books Amy Semple McPherson or some Amy Semple McPherson-esque figure appears in these novels of the 30s. Do you know that book?
I've as you described that plot, yeah, that book has kind of crossed my radar at some point. But yeah, you're right, though. It's sort of... It's the flutter of an eyelid.
She's in there. Well, she has that great line about love where she goes, the love is in the scotch. because God's love is everywhere. Well, on that happy note, thank you all for coming. I'd like to thank my good friend, Mr. Rayner, for... and go buy his book, please. And... also, if you are so inclined, there are jars. Yes, there is a jar for donations to the Aloud series, to the Library Foundation. Please give generously so Louise can keep this great program going. Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.